and welcome to LedgerCast. I'm here with special guest host today, as Josh is out for the next couple of weeks. I have the guys from the Coin Talk show, Jay Kang and Aaron Lamer. Hey guys.
Hey.
Yo.
How are you?
Where is he? Where is he these 2 weeks? Where is he traveling?
He is traveling to New Zealand. So.
Oh, lucky man.
Whoa, that's where my sister lives.
Really?
I think
Brave New Coin is based out of there, so he's going to visit those guys or something along those lines. Nevertheless, he can't.
Do they have a bunker down there like Peter Thiel and the?
Yeah.
are they starting the first string of crypto bunkers?
No, I was surprised with this Portopia stuff. It feels like New Zealand is the logical place to go in a crypto apocalypse, not Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I think
it's kind of a
New Zealand is a popular prepper location anyway, so it only makes sense to be some crypto headquarters. So maybe Josh is seeing the end, and you know he's going for it.
He knows something we don't know. How do you feel about him not bringing you on his life raft?
Yeah, pretty disappointed. He didn't give me the heads up that we were gonna lose some sleep and a lot of money this week.
Yeah, he's like, "Oh, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Sure, Ledge. Yeah, I'll see you then."
He might know something about this North Korean Bitcoin stealing from South Korea thing that might lead to apocalypse.
Yeah.
Getting the head start on all
the North Koreans are super bullish on Bitcoin, which I'm not sure if that's super bullish for Bitcoin.
You can be super bullish if what you do is steal Bitcoin, yeah. You know? Like, the price doesn't really matter so much. If I could steal billions of dollars of Bitcoin from South Korea, then I would be super bullish regardless of the price. I'd be like, "Oh, it dropped to 4,000. That's fine. Like, yeah. We'll just steal some more."
It is interesting how, like, some of the most useful things to do with cryptocurrencies are things that are not tied to price, like money laundering, dealing other people's cryptocurrencies. It's a good idea at any price.
Yeah, the price doesn't affect them as much. I assume with alternative methods for those types of activities, and I really only know this because I watched Breaking Bad, but they tend to be expensive. So the premium for money laundering through crypto is probably a little lower. Not that I have any personal
experience.
Breaking
Bad, if Breaking Bad came out this year, it definitely would involve like a large crypto.
Oh, definitely.
I would enjoy that.
There'd be like a huge, like, there'd be like a point where someone like lost a jump drive with like $100 million of Monero on it.
So as listeners can probably gather by the first couple minutes of this conversation, this is not going to be the most technical episode we've done on LedgerCast.
These two guys clearly don't know any math.
So why don't y'all do me a favor, and we'll start with you, Aaron, and just tell me, one, what is the Coin Talk show, and who are you, and we'll go from there.
I'm Aaron Lamer. I'm the co-host of Coin Talk. Coin Talk is a new-ish crypto podcast hosted by Jay and I, who are both not really from the crypto world, but are kind of obsessives. Jay's a gambler. I just get obsessed with lots of things. And we're kind of trying to document our journey into crypto and share it with other people who are getting into it. Is that accurate, Jay? Is that about right?
Yeah, it sounds
and
right.
Aaron,
and I also host the Long Form Podcast.
Yeah.
Yes, I am self-employed. Can you tell by my cluttered basement?
I think your basement looks awesome.
I am a co-founder of Longform, and I co-host the Longform podcast. And I have another podcast called Stoner, which is about creativity and weed. And I'm also part of a band called Francis and the Lights.
Nice. So Longform, for people that don't know, is like one of those landmark podcasts that gets gazillions of listeners, and Aaron started that. Last time I talked to Aaron,
I was impressed that you knew it.
I didn't realize it was him until at the very end. I was like, "I know your voice, and I don't know why." And it's because I've listened to him interview a lot of people.
Generally, when I meet people and who are like involved in TA, I don't expect that they listen to journalism podcasts. Mm-hmm. Long form mostly interviews nonfiction writers, and so I didn't even think that you might know it. Although it is how I know Jay. I interviewed Jay on that podcast, and that was how we first met.
Is that how y'all met?
Yep.
So Jay, where do you come from?
I'm similar to Aaron, although I think probably more on the degenerate side. A lot of my interest in crypto. And I am a correspondent on Vice News Tonight, which is HBO news show. And then I'm the writer at large at the New York Times Magazine. which and so I'm a journalist, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Jay's a media elite.
definitely elite. He doesn't let me forget it either.
I pump out the fake news on all channels.
That's right.
And I try all the FUD that's put out there by the mainstream media is actually just me. I tell everyone, hey guys, you know, this Tether thing is a big deal. You should really look into it. China is definitely banning all Bitcoin mining. And Korea is totally fucked. Nobody's going to be able to buy or sell a Bitcoin there. So that's my other job, is spreading FUD throughout the media. Awesome.
And Jay, you were part of the original team for Grantland, for the sports fans out there. And I think that's kind of a good reference.
How wrecked is Bill Simmons today?
Lord only knows. He seemed actually kind of, all these Patriots fans are acting like, oh, I knew they were going to lose the Super Bowl.
I don't think. Oh, you mean like wrecked emotionally? I thought you meant like how much Bitcoin.
No, not about Bitcoin. I'm talking about because he's a Patriots homer to the max.
I think it seemed like he was taking it in stride.
All these Patriots fans are doing this. Max Linsky, like, my love.
Whatever, we've won so many times.
Like, oh, I really knew this one wasn't going to go well.
I know. Look, like the civility now is not, I'm going to reject it every time I see it. I'm going to be like, you guys cheated. If you spent 2 years whining about how you're punished for cheating, and now you're like, oh, well, we can be the bigger people. Come on, get out of here.
The fuck out of here.
So I got to know you guys. I think first I saw the segment you did on Vice, Jay, where you said, or you did a whole segment on what it's like to be obsessed with Bitcoin, which was hilarious. And then y'all reached out to me to be on your podcast, which was brand new. So y'all have done just a handful of episodes now.
We're up to six
episodes, and it's been really great. Ever since I was on your show, we've been chatting a good bit and just talking about the markets.
Quite a bit. Yeah.
Which has been a lot of fun. And basically since we started those chats, it's mostly felt like a death spiral.
There's a very realistic theory that we cursed the market by starting CoinTalk. I don't think we have a single green weekly candle between episodes. Every episode, we have sent the market down.
Yeah, so
it really does feel like it. Like we were doing fake like practice episodes for a while, and Aaron and I would talk about how it was kind of boring because the market kept going up, and we need to find something other to talk about other than like, hey, we're getting slightly richer every single week.
Yeah.
And then we actually launched a show, and now it's just been like, oh, what are we talking about? That's not depressing.
It was better when we were getting slightly richer every week than when we were getting significantly poorer every week.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things, you know, we go with the ebbs and flows of the market, and sometimes those ebbs and flows are pretty severe.
I've actually got a question for you, Lex.
Yeah, what's
I've got
that?
A question because we were just discussing this. So I don't know where my phone's on airplane mode, but I don't know where Bitcoin is right now. It was around 7,000 ish when we started this call. When did we pass here on the way up?
I'd have to look at the daily to be specific, but I think it was October.
6926.
October. Okay. Circa October. Yeah. Cause we were discussing, we taped like preseason episodes that we didn't release. And I was trying to remember, like trying to pair up my memory of our episode of how it felt, coming up the roller coaster as we passed 7,000. And, last night, I think we got to experience coming down past 7,000.
Yeah. I think we made the
Brian Harry
break into 7,000 on Halloween.
I remember that night.
Oh my God. Yeah. I put my daughter in an owl costume. It feels like years ago. Brian, how are you holding up with all this price action?
Yeah, so it's been fast. I've been fascinated by this whole thing. Like, obviously, I personally have, anyone that listens to this or follows me on Twitter, I have a bullish bias for crypto. You know, going into this whole thing, I wasn't looking at this current market and thinking we would hit greater than a 70% correction, which we've done. We've pretty clearly broken the parabola of growth, if you will. People gave Peter Brandt a lot of crap about that. And you know, you got to be right eventually. So maybe it's that scenario. Every correction, he tends to put out like a super bearish tweet or something, but he can claim victory on this one. I'm still super bullish on crypto. However, the road to, like, you know, 100,000 plus, I think is probably healthy the route we're going to go, because I think it would have been dangerous if we went into the super blow off top to 50,000 plus in the next few months, which would have been possible if we maintained that mega curve we're on. So this is the painful downside of that. So the way I'm personally handling it is a little disappointing, because I didn't catch it soon enough. And then once I did, I didn't take it seriously enough. So I thought, like, okay, well, this or this or this level looks okay. And when I really got beat up was the break off around 11.5, which essentially started the third big drive of this dip that's led us to here. For listeners, today's February 6th, and we hit a low of around just under 5,900. Last night while I was sleeping, this is how these things go as well. So that's been a challenge, you know, off 19,000. And fortunately for me, and I think for you guys too.
Do you guys pull refresh when you take a piss at night in the middle of the night? Are you tempted to do one pull on there?
You can safely say that when I'm awake, I'm aware of the Bitcoin price within $100.
I have an internal debate about whether to pull refresh during night pees.
Yeah,
that's it.
The sign of
I've been trying.
The sign of the market being close to reversal is probably when you're afraid to look at the price.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we're going back up.
Very much so. Very much so.
Yeah, I tried not to check at all last night or this morning, but because I was just thinking, this is too
much. One of the things that bums me out, like, it makes me sad, but it's also natural for a market. You know, they say money is, or markets are designed to take money from the masses and give it to the few. I think one thing we're seeing is essentially washing out people that came in to the market after Thanksgiving. Anybody that entered the market after Thanksgiving, unless they traded this well or shorted rather than long, whatever, a lot of them are taking a massive beating. I mean, I'm taking it.
If you owned Ripple between Thanksgiving and New Year's, you're never going to invest in crypto.
Yeah. So it's been a struggle for anybody new to the market. And it's easy when the market's going up to say, like, it'll never be cheap again. I might as well buy now and ride the wave. And historically, when, you know, in a bull run, that's basically true with Bitcoin as well. And in a multi-month sense, that may continue to be true. Like, we could correct off of this violently and go up. But because of the degree of the correction, it looks to me like the road upward, at least to meet prior all-time highs, could be quite the road indeed. You know, it could take a while. It's not going to be the quick riches that everybody wants. And when you look at a market, that's how it should be. However, you know, hindsight's 20/20. So a lot of people that are in the market now are probably down 70, 80, even 90%, depending on what they were investing in. And that's freaking brutal. And a lot of them are going to get washed out, completely disappear. Those who stick around, you know, I think eventually they'll be rewarded. What do y'all think? How are you handling things?
Yeah, congratulations to the one guy in November who was like, I'm not going to download Coinbase. I'm going to sign up for BitMEX. And my first introduction into crypto is going to be to do a 25X short of Bitcoin.
I would like to meet that
guy. Is the one new... I know, I really would like to meet that guy because he's brilliant. Brian, I have a question for you too, which was, I mean, are you afraid at all of any of this, like, regulatory action? Like, is that why you think it's going to be a long road ahead? Is it intervention, or is it just sort of normal price stuff that you think is going to be difficult to recover because so many people did seem to get washed out of this thing?
No, I'm looking at this more from a price perspective, and I do want to get into regulation. There was a pretty important meeting today in the Senate where senators asked the chairman of the SEC and the chairman of the CFTC, did I say that? Something like that. the futures one.
Someone with an acronym talking about crypto.
So they answered questions to the United States Senate. We heard HODL on a Senate committee hearing, which was amazing. Nice. I heard the kimchi premium, which I've never heard before, and I'm pretty sure that sounds offensive. I don't know. But there were, like, lots of things that were thrown out that I never would have guessed.
Jay says he'll allow kimchi
premium. As a Korean, I'm okay with it. Brian, you can say it. Aaron can't.
So that was an interesting experience. Overall, though, the regulatory environment will affect the market. That's not what I'm looking at when I think in terms of what this recovery will take. I'm looking at it in terms of purely technicals, what we've seen in the past, and what I think it could take to, you know, get to all-time high and beyond. And I think that could be a while. That would be my aside on that. So
I have a question about that. One yeah. follow up.
You can tell these guys do a podcast because they're asking me questions.
Yeah. Sorry, we're reversing the dynamic here. I was just wondering, how important do you think new people are to the recovery? Like, how much does the recovery require an influx of new investors? If this last rise had a big drive of new people who we now lost 80-90%, some of them.
Sure. I think that we're seeing an incredibly large shift of crypto assets going from retail investors to institutional investors and big investors. Mm. And whether that's people historically involved, like, you know, crypto whales that are just got out of the market at the right time and were ready to buy this, which that certainly was a lot. There was certainly a lot of that. I think a lot of what we're seeing right now, especially these drives to just go lower and lower and lower, people making markets, I think that's institutional money that is doing what institutional money can do very well. And retail investors are going to be the one that can't stomach it. So I think we're seeing crypto be institutionalized a bit with some of this. Would y'all agree? Or do you think that some retail people can help it survive? Like, they'll come back, but they'll come back when it's more expensive, in my opinion. Like, they won't catch the lows.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, it would have to recover, I think, and return to something that kind of looked like a parabolic rise, and we'd have to be decently into it, don't you think?
I
think I'm on tilt to that. I want retail people to be into it. I think it's more fun when it's individuals playing the game than when it's institutional bots playing the game. But I feel like retail investors are the most sensitive to just what just happened. So when Bitcoin had just doubled, it was like, oh, that's what's going to happen next. And when Bitcoin just took a 60-70% dive, it's a difficult time to attract new players, I would think.
Yeah. You know, our psychological response is typically to do the wrong thing. Like, we're basically, we should contra trade our emotions. And I think what we see in most retail investors is they're not willing to get in until it's probably later than it should be to get in. That's what creates these euphoric tops, these massive in runs, and they're on that latter half. And unless they're good enough to get out of it at the right moment, they're probably going to be the ones to get burned. And the institutions and the long-term investors, or the people that have done enough homework to be able to survive, they understand those market cycles and those market dynamics. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think is really unfortunate about a market, but me and you, we're not going to change that. So it's just how it is.
Capitalism is not sentiment.
And, you know, this isn't just crypto. In fact, it's age-old market psychology that we've seen over and over again. And look at where else we're seeing it just this week. At the same time Bitcoin was tanking, the stock market also took some incredible dives over the past couple of days. So are you guys into the regular stock market? Are you watching that as much as crypto?
Yeah, I probably watch it a little bit more at this point, not with the same emotions and with the same fun, but I certainly, you know, it's much more important to me financially. Mm-hmm. But I agree that it was the same thing that happened. You know, I actually was talking to my wife about this because she was saying last week, she was like, I think we should hedge a bit because it seems like some of this is going to come tumbling down. And I was like, whatever, you know, like, we got another year of this. And you're right. It was just because it was like a certain greed factor had kicked in where I was just like looking at crypto and crypto was kind of stumbling down. And then I was looking at the S&P and I was like, well, this is, you know, this is going to just keep going up and it's just printing money and we're going to be good. And I should have counter traded my emotions on both, you know, like I should have not been like, well, I think crypto is going to turn around. And I should have just sold off a lot of my crypto. And I also should have probably sold off a lot of my stock holdings. But I don't know. It's
into
a little
what,
bit.
But into what? Into cat? Just to cash?
Yeah. I mean, I should have just hedged with, like, you know, I should have opened up some sort of shorts on the S&P. I should have just done something instead of just kind of blindly hoping that things would keep
shorting
going
the
up.
S&P is really difficult and dangerous. I have a friend that's been bearish on the regular market for a long time, and he's been buying an it's like a ultra short that you can buy through the regular market. And man, that thing's just gone down and down and down and down. And there are other people that they tend to be naturally bearish on the market. And for a couple of years now, because the market can be rational for a long time, maybe they've been buying gold or silver or whatever, and they just really took a hit. So the market was the right place to be. And it may still be. To me, you're always going to take a lop off the top if you take as much out of the market as you can. So like if you look at the current stock market, or if you look at what Bitcoin did, say from 20,000 to 17,000, and you identify that, hey, this is different. This is a different level of volume. This is a different level of drop. And you get out and you're right, then you're in cash before like 90% of the people. But you also took advantage of the market as much as possible. Now, if you're wrong, like let's say the stock market goes back and hits new all-time highs and beyond, then you jump back in, you lost 10% if you were wrong. If you're right, then you might miss another significant drop in the market. And like that's where I think you have to be careful. And you also want to be able to do as much trend confirmation as possible. So as much as I personally, like I agree with you, I totally want to short the S&P on a rejection bounce. Like say when it gets a little back up, you know, close to those highs, but not there, I would love to short that market. Whether I have the guts to do it, I don't know, because the stock market loves to go up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when like the entire narrative of the country's government right now is pegged to the stock market going up. You know, it's literally the only good thing that can be said by, or let's not get too political here, but you know, it does seem to be the favorite talking point of the parties in power right now. And so I don't know the amount of I can't honestly remember in my entire lifetime. And maybe this is just because I'm older now, but I just can't remember a time when there was this much focus in the entire country on the stock market. Like, can you?
I think the tech bubble was probably the last time, right?
I think this is more like, you know, even during the tech bubble, it wasn't like the president was talking about it all the time.
Well,
you know, like,
and there was y'all aren't willing to get political. I'm willing to say at least one thing, which is a president bragging about stock market gains is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
because we didn't want to step on your podcast.
The way market, no, I'm just strictly from a market perspective. The way markets work is they correct. And if you're going to be president for 4 years, which is going to be determined, then you're going to eat your own words at some point, you know, like,
I know.
Yeah.
Trump is basically like parabolic Trav right now. like he'll be silent throughout this whole correction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, can I have a question about that. I mean, I'm probably the least financially sophisticated person who's ever been on this podcast, but I always thought that the prevailing belief was that in case of a stock market crash, crypto would go up. Like if I told you at some point in 2017, the Dow is going to lose 1,500 points in a day, what do you think Bitcoin's going to do that day? What have you said up?
You know, I've been thinking about this a good bit. And the quick answer...
2018, sorry, not 2017, 2018.
Yeah, the quick answer is on a daily basis, there may be some immediate correlation just because, you know, it's money fleeing or like instant panic type stuff.
Yeah.
I've heard some people talk about this, and I tend to agree with it, that the decorrelation happens over time. So most people would look at like metals markets or commodities markets as decorrelated from traditional stocks. So, but if you look at those, they went down too. Like you look at like gold mining or, you know, gold itself, silver, they didn't take the same type of hit the stock market took, but they still took a hit.
Yep.
So the decorrelation may take some time.
Yeah.
The last time we really had a market situation worth worrying about, if you're not the type of person that pays really close attention, was the 2008 financial crisis, which was a massive correction. And most people would be better off just staying in the traditional market with whatever they have in the traditional market, unless we hit that type of panic, that type of downtrend. What we've seen so far is no different than what you tend to see in election years, which is just moments of uncertainty. So 2012 and 2016, prior to elections, we saw similar immediate downturn type panics. But then, you know, within a few weeks, you're basically back to normal. If you get past that few weeks and you keep making a downtrend, like that's a sign that the trend is turning against you and maybe you exit the market. That's that whole concept of, you know, getting out while you still have most of your money intact. But your average person should just stay in through all of it. The worst thing you can do is not be in the market when it's ready to respond. And that's what we're seeing in Bitcoin right now too. Like, there are some people fleeing the market right now and they'll never come back. When in fact, and whether it's 3,000, like, we could not be, you know, we could have another 50% to go. But the point is, if you were in at 19, 20, 17, 14, by the time you get to 6,000, 7,000, now you're getting out, the market will get back to this point. And if you didn't make the right trade at 14 or 15, like I should have done, panic selling at 6 and 7, that's when you hit that capitulation. That's a market cycle concept. And that is pretty much the worst time to sell. And most people would be better off just holding it. You said guilty. So I want to know, emotionally, what did you guys go through as the market really started to tank?
We were just talking about this, actually. We were talking about how there's three states to your bags, to your overall egg, right? If when you're up, obviously a lot of people, when they're way up, particularly in crypto, playing with house money, willing to be very risky. In my case, buying Cryptopia alts. That's a behavior that I got into. I didn't do that right off the bat. I did that when I was like up a bunch of money already.
How's your Sumo bag?
I was like, Sumo, RIP Sumo. Although actually Sumo's up like 30% today, but that's after getting absolutely crushed. Yeah. And I also found out that there's another another Monero clone that's like a scam, which I don't think is probably good for Sumo in the long run. Monero Gold is a scam, apparently. Shocking. Shocking.
Oh, no, I don't believe it.
So that's one state. And then there's the state when you're like around zero, like when you're around like a break even. And then there's the I'm down state. And I'm guessing that like most people who are capitulating in that down state. And my emotional journey was I experienced all three states. And the time when I was the most induced to panic sell was when I was around the break even state. That was when I was kind
US
of
dollars.
Like, US dollars. I was kind of like, okay, you could just sort of cancel the whole thing right now. Sort of
fun game.
And that was where I panic sold. Once I was actually down, I was kind of like, oh, well, now it's better to just stay in. Now I'm stuck in. So I wonder when we look at these crashes and sort of where the bottoms are, when you talked about those new people, like I'm always thinking about like, well, where is the new person's break even? Where do they start thinking about capitulating? I think most people aren't going to sell and like keep half of their profits, but a lot of people, when they start seeing a zero after they've been up a lot, are like, oh, this would be the time if I was going to sell. Well, how did you experience it, Jay?
This is not something I exercise in any portion of my life, but I think because I really did only buy in what I could lose without losing any sleep, I think I've been able to be a little bit, see it as kind of a bit more humorous, you know? And so like, I am in it partially for the memes and the content. And I do think that actions have been pretty funny. So I don't know. I haven't been upset ever. I did have a moment where I was like, oh shit. You know, I used to have a lot more money in this than I do now. But I think that the one thing that when we're talking about capitulation, I did sell about 20% off around 6,000 to 7,000, like you were saying. But the reason I was doing it, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, because I certainly trust your opinion over my own or Aaron's. Not to insult Aaron here, but you know, Aaron and I both have no idea what we're doing. I've made more bad decisions than Aaron, I will say that. Is that I was basically just saying, look, I want to free up a little bit of fiat in case this thing does crack down further so that I can capitalize on it. Like, I'm not really envisioning a world in which I sort of take stuff off of take US dollars off an exchange and put it in my bank account and never put it back into a crypto market.
Right.
But
you're staying in the market. You're just wondering, is it too late to panic or is it too late to sell and buy lower?
Yeah, because like you at 15, not at 15, honestly, but at 11, 5, at 9, at 8, and then at 7, I always had that thought. I was like, I should sell off a little bit of this right now in case it dips further. And I didn't do it. And then I finally just decided to do it. And I think that there probably is some psychological like trend to when I decided to do it. Maybe that actually is bottom, you know, like when I actually decided to pull the trigger. But I don't know. Like, do you think that I shouldn't have done that? Because if I had done that at 11 or even 9, it would have been a good decision. Like, do you not see this going down further? Because I guess I just like kind of see, I don't see why it's not possible that we dip down to like 3 or 4,000.
I sold some at 74, also basically same psychology. Like, I need something to buy at 3 if we hit 3 or something.
Yeah. I think the just-in-case mentality is correct. I think the way... I can't answer that question for everybody because the likelihood of... Or not likelihood, but the chance that you will experience more pain, that 58, 63 or whatever I'm looking at that we hit, say, last night is the bottom, that is not a guarantee. It's never a guarantee. And in this market, you know, I looked at it when at the 7,700 or whatever that was at that time. My reasoning for personally staying in the market was the same as it was, it is now. And obviously there's a more than $1,000 change, almost a $2,000 change between then and now. So if you capitulate early, if you have weak enough hands, you almost have a better shot if the market does have that continued downturn. I do think statistically you reach a point where you might as well just hold on. And, you know, I've encountered these scenarios plenty of times, even in this. Like, I have not made as many adjustments as I would have liked to with my own portfolio. However, I'm looking at it now and thinking, okay, well, one, I'm looking mostly relative Bitcoin. Like Jay, I risked enough to where if the US dollars went completely away, it's not the end of the world. What does give me a great degree of self-hatred is knowing what's your US dollar all-time high and how much Bitcoin could you buy with that today?
That really upsets me.
That one hurts.
Yeah, because like my dad visited me about a month ago when alts were running, and I think I was at a personal all-time high in US dollars, and he was like, "You should just sell off half." That was the first thing he said, and I was like, first of all, don't tell me what to do, Dad, you know? and I was like, you don't understand this. And he was like, yeah, I don't understand it, but it seems like it's a pretty good idea. And I'll just buy it when it crashes down to 3. And I was like, it'll never go down below 10,000 again. And I am really upset that he might be right on both. So if you see a big spike at 3, it will be that the Kang family collectively has bought a lot more Bitcoin. But yeah, that was my big thing about it. It's just like, man, if I had sold off half when I was a personal all-time high, how much more Bitcoin would I have right now? You know, like I certainly would have been trying to buy all the way down, you know? So that is I'm with you. That's my biggest like regret.
And that's the realistic scenario too, is if people sold at their all-time high, and I know some people that did cash out a significant amount then, they are probably averaging in on the way down. So you're never going to be able to capture that very bottom. Josh is always really good about kind of distancing himself from his own emotions and saying like, I'm never going to catch the top and the bottom of the market. I want to catch the middle 80%. One of the things I've come to learn in crypto is that the middle 80% is actually damn good for catching the bulk of the move. Like, yeah. I think it's almost difficult to even catch 50% of the move because of the way our emotions work about delaying when we buy in and delaying when we sell out.
Can I propose a strategy there? I feel like the best advice that was given to me as a new when I was really first buying was to cost average in. Yeah. You're going to put in a certain amount of fiat. Don't just dump it all in one day. Set some sort of a schedule, and then you capture if the market goes down. Great, you're getting more. If the market goes up, like boohoo.
Not that we're giving financial advice in this.
Not
podcast,
that we're giving financial.
This is all given
advice,
for but, educational but
we,
material.
We all wish that we had sold some above 10,000 to be buying to have bought in the 6,000s. Right, that's a universal.
I wish that I would have sold some above 15. Or about maybe around 14 or 15, because I play a lot of alts, was my personal USD all-time high.
Right. So I'm wondering,
you're never
going to
play the market perfectly. So averaging in and averaging out is definitely a good way to go.
So that was my question. No one really told me to average out, so I didn't do it. I was told to average in, and I was told to hodl, which is what I did. And
yeah, the hodl mentality is a dangerous one that gets repeated a lot, but I'm not sure why.
It seems like every time the market makes a move of, I don't know, 25%, you ought to average out slightly so that you're selling the way up, so that that fiat to buy, you know, to buy when it's down is there. My problem, the stupid thing I did was I was firing at dips that were not dips. I was firing like when it went from like 17,000 to 15,000. I was like, yeah, get it on. Like, buy that dip. And so I bought all these dips that were like well above 10,000, which weren't actually dips. Like that sort of hodl and buy the dips mentality assumes that every time it goes down, it's the dip to buy. And some of these dips aren't really to buy, I don't think. I should have been averaging out at those highs rather than buying in on those dips, I think, is my life lesson.
Yeah. Well, this is where I think a couple of concepts come in handy. One is understanding the idea of returning to the mean. So if you, and this is where I personally am a proponent of technical analysis tools. So like if you look at something, let's just say moving averages, okay? And you have a 50-day moving average and you get really far from it. And we did an episode on this. If you're really far from that moving average, it's going to want to come back to that moving average because it's a moving average. And if you sell into those moments in partials, you're taking profits and you might not catch the top. You may have sold too early, whatever. And that's probably a good thing. And then if you buy on additional moving averages, maybe not the 50-day, but maybe 100-day. Like that's buying the dip. If you buy on those moments or whatever your philosophy is for when you buy, you also need to be prepared to respond to that beyond buying the dip. So like you buy the dip and you also give yourself a stop loss to say, if this goes another 10 or 15% below where I bought the dip, then I cut the loss on as a bad trade. And no trader makes the right decision 100% of the time, but it's easy to feel overconfident in an overly bullish market. So we should be qualifying our trades with being okay with being wrong more and not just continuously buying the dip, because when you do exit the bullish market and you have a 70% correction like we've had, you're going to receive the rewards. And
can't believe you didn't use the train wreck sound effect there on the 70% dip. That was the time for the explosion sound effect.
Yeah, we've definitely had some serious wreckage during this correction. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Brian, and I've been enjoying your Telegram channel. Because I feel like it is I enjoy your Twitter presence, obviously, but I think that you're able to explain things a little bit more. Like, what happened last night where the curve just started accelerating so quickly? I mean, and were you surprised by that?
No, that's kind of where the concept of capitulation comes in. And thanks for the plug, by the way. So if other people want to learn, you can go to a very special URL, go to ledgerstatus.com/learn, and there's a program for you. To learn more about analysis, right now I'm doing a free Telegram channel where I'm just kind of expounding on thoughts that are hard to do via Twitter. And what Jay is referring to is essentially the third drive of this. If you look at it in a chart, it looks like this just giant puking megaphone going down. It's this downtrend that's like at a 45 degree angle with the whole megaphone. And then the worst parts of it, like what we've experienced over the last couple of days, it looks almost 90 degrees if you're just looking at it on a chart, not in log. Like it's just this massive dump. And that is what capitulation looks like. It's also what a euphoric moment looks like. You know, when Coinbase went to 20,000 and then it was like 18,000 5 minutes later, it's kind of a similar concept.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually a really good sign of reversal. What's been particularly brutal about this one is we've done those multiple days in a row, basically. So like we're hitting that moment and then we're having this prayer of a recovery that doesn't last.
Yeah.
And then we're doing it again.
It's like getting kicked in the balls repeatedly. That one was a little better than the last one. And then you're kicked
and if you're
in the
holding
balls
through
again,
that
you're like,
whole
nope,
time,
that was terrible again.
Yeah, if you're holding through that whole time, then it's just super painful.
Are you just looking at Bitcoin mostly right now, or are you also looking at alt charts?
The way I'm looking at this is alts are going to respond even more aggressively in downward momentum, and they're going to respond more aggressively with upward momentum as well.
Yeah.
So they'll bounce harder and they'll fall harder, both.
Because I'm just noticing that, like, just looking at my own blockfolio right now, my alts are, this is the first day my alts have not been kicked in the balls, but Bitcoin's basically flat for, this is like the last 24 hours.
Yeah. I think what you see is you kind of remove people that are going to panic dump during these because they've already done it. So I think the initial bounce for alts might be a little stronger than for Bitcoin, because for Bitcoin, you'll still have sellers that are, you know, like, thank God, let me get out of this market. It came back to 8,000 or 9,000. So like, it might be a little tougher road, whereas the altcoins are a little more illiquid. People might panic there first and send it to Bitcoin, and then they panic on Bitcoin, stuff like that.
That was actually part of my psychology at the panic sell was, oh my God, I should just sell everything. Oh God, I'm going to try and transfer this Bitcoin off of, sell these alts, then transfer the Bitcoin. That's how I was like, it's too much work. There's no way. Yeah. I'm going to go through all of the steps of getting my Sumo coin to a place I can exchange it for US dollars. Too many jumps.
Yeah, and sometimes that can be beneficial, essentially. The lack of ease in moving the coins and everything else can be beneficial with alts. For the most part, though, if you're in alts, you probably lost a decent amount of money.
Oh, yeah.
Even more than being in Bitcoin. My personal opinion is that alts will also be a beneficiary, at least in the near term, of the bounce. So if you sold all your alts into Bitcoin today, you're essentially stuck with whatever that Bitcoin relative value is, because now you're in Bitcoin.
Right.
Whereas if you're in alts, maybe over the next couple of days, assuming we've hit a local bottom, looking at the anti-parabolic Trav curve, which is the downward parabolic curve, we hit the bottom of the parabola. So like, it's basically as steep as you can make that parabola. So my assumption personally is that we do have a local low that we hit last night, and we'll see a little bit of a recovery off of this. Smart hedge, if we're not done, might be once we're facing resistance on the upward side, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. Maybe you do get out of some of those alt positions, assuming they responded better than Bitcoin, and at least get back into Bitcoin, maybe even put 10-20% in fiat to buy another dip if we have it, whatever. Kind of depends on someone's scenario. I do think one of the things I've learned from this is, and I knew this was coming in some way, and I didn't respond well enough, was I was in too many alts, too many coins in general, and responding to changes in the market was incredibly difficult.
How many coins were you in at when it started coming down?
I'm in like 10 or 12, which is about half of what I was in, but it's still too many to respond well.
I was in 11. I just counted. And I was thinking about setting a rule for myself of it has to fit on the front page of Blockfolio, which is 7 slots going forward.
Yeah, and I don't think that's bad advice in general. If you have more than that, you're essentially playing an index fund anyway, and you're like, so you're not going to reap any more benefits than whatever the market as a whole reaps, and you'll be inflexible.
And it makes you crazy.
I actually think one of the neat products that people could build would be essentially an index of the market.
We had that idea a while ago where Aaron was going to, this was around the time when Aaron was going to have his baby. And then he was like, I'm going to buy every single coin on Bittrex.
These are things. So I wanted to track these, at least I'm still going to do this on the web. I do think that there's individual sets of coins that would be interesting to track together. A Bittrex index, a Cryptopia index, a privacy coin index, all of the privacy coins. How did they perform as a cohort? Because generally, like, what you hear talked about is like, oh, privacy coins. And then people talk about Monero and Zcash. I'd like to see like a weighted index that's, yeah, it's primarily Zcash and Monero, but hey, there's a little Sumo at the bottom. There's a little zero coin in there, you know?
These products are absolutely coming to the market. I even tested one and then I got burned by it. And it's one where essentially you can create a portfolio and people can clone your portfolio and essentially treat it like an index. And then you can go reshuffle it and all that stuff. I found out the hard way, because I missed a lot of gains off of it, is once you hit 100% gain, they automatically close it on you.
Oh, that's what is that? What is that called? That's like Prism or something like that?
Yeah, I wasn't going to call them out, but it's Shapeshift's product.
Yeah,
it's
Prism.
Called the Prism Exchange. And I really love the idea. I did not love the implementation, unfortunately.
Who caps crypto at 100%? It's got to at least be 1,000%.
What I ran into
be crypto.
Yeah, so I missed because I couldn't figure out how to get the money back out of the account, because this is all a smart contract. And it said it settled my contract. And I was like, one, why did this settle? I didn't tell it to. And two, where is my money and how do I get it? Because it was back in Ethereum, which wasn't the worst play. But I was in Stratus and Siacoin on their like big runs. And when it hit 100%, it melted it.
Oh my God.
And sent it back to Ethereum. It absolutely infuriated me, because I was like, I just missed half of these runs because I've spent 7 days in support trying to find out where my money is.
Brian, do you think then, obviously none of this is financial support, I mean financial advice, but as you know, I am along with you, I'm a big 0x believer, and I sold out of it completely between like 15 and 20,000, well not 15 and 17,000. Is now a good time to get back into the projects that you like sort of believe in, do you think, if you were like me and you're just like, I'm just going to consolidate?
Some of the people that I respect the most, their buying activity is typically when other people are crying and waiting on the market to shift. One of my good friends bought the crap out of the blood last night in altcoins. So he essentially is going by the same philosophy of thinking he's going to see an altcoin bounce that's more aggressive than the Bitcoin one. So yeah, I mean, if you can find an altcoin that took a humongous drop, it could be. I mean, if you look at ZRX specifically, I saw it all the way down to like 10K. Now it's like 12.5. You sold between 15 and 17 or 15 and 20. So you would still be lowering your price if you bought back in today.
Yeah.
When I look at the alt market generally, there is one chart that really worries me right now, and that is alts versus USD, because every single alt USD chart essentially tanked all the way down to their prior consolidation zones where they were in November to December. It's as if December and January didn't happen when they all went to these massive spikes. And I don't know how they'll respond in the long term, because they look very much like a market cycle if you look on the USD chart. They're like Bitcoin, except worse. Like, they're like the Ripple chart. And almost every alt USD chart looks like that. I'm really curious how they're going to come out of that, because it's significantly different than their historical price rises. So
I actually, the ones I sold on the way down, I only sold two alts on the way down. And they were the ones that weren't that. I was like, well, as long as Monero, I think it was Monero and Aragon, were like kind of surprisingly unwrecked. And I was like, everything's getting wrecked. Maybe they're probably next in line to get wrecked. I might as well sell them into Bitcoin here. Do you believe in like moving around alts in a situation like that? Or if you get caught in a crash with alts, just hold on for dear life?
It's hard to say, man. I've held alts through some terrible times. And some definitely respond differently than others. I think this is one of the reasons why it's worth considering an altcoin's fundamentals, because I think in these really terrible times, the first ones to go are going to be the ones with garbage fundamentals.
Yeah.
So if you look at something like Monero, it's got a certain crew, a certain group of loyalists that are always going to treat Monero as their favorite altcoin. So it may handle the downturn a little better.
Yeah.
Some of these have been vicious. Like, I swear Zcash loves to go down when the market overall is healthy, and it loves to, like, it was the only green alt these last few days. And I think it's just Barry, just letting people know he's in charge. That's what it looks like to me. So I don't know, man. I mean, my personal philosophy is, at a minimum, wait on that throwback.
Yeah. That's what I'm
like. If you have a 25-30% day, if you do that two or three days in a row, that's completely vicious, but eventually you have to have a kickback from it. Like, you have to have people that are willing to go down and they buy those coins for cheap and they'll throw the price back up and then wait and make your decision then.
Yeah. Ironically, I shed now, my best alt. Like, I think Monero, like, I actually think Monero and Aragon are legit because of how they behave there, yet I sold them. So I probably will buy back into them.
Yeah. So we've talked about Aragon. We've talked about ZRX. Those are both token securities. Kind of where I want to finish up this podcast is to get a little bit into what was discussed in the Senate hearing.
Oh, yeah.
So this was Jay Clayton from the SEC and Christopher Giancarlo is from the CFTC or whatever it's called, the futures version of the regulatory bodies. The Senate asked them questions. I had a few takeaways, but I want to know first, did you guys watch what was going on?
I watched a little and then I followed it on Twitter.
Yeah, I followed mostly on Twitter, which means I have an incomplete and probably hyperbolic understanding of what happened.
Okay, well, my TLDR off of it, I was tweeting about it as well, was that overall, they're pretty progressive on blockchain. They like blockchain. Everybody likes blockchain. currency style coins. So like, I don't know about privacy coins per se, but like, let's say like your Dash and Monero, Zcash, whatever, you know, your currencies, they were kind of like, I don't understand what the value of this is necessarily, but they're okay. Like they're not really bothering us. Jay Clayton specifically was hardcore acting against securities. He even had a couple of quotes that I thought were really fascinating. One, he said, I believe every ICO I've ever seen is a security, which in my opinion, if that holds up or like if enforcement bodies come into play, puts existing projects in risk.
Isn't Ethereum an ICO though?
Yes. And I don't know how it affects things that existed before. And then my fourth thing, which I think we all agree as well, is scams and pump and dump stuff. They're going to come after harder and harder. But what I want to focus on is this ICO stuff, because so Giancarlo, I thought, said some really smart things, seemed to have a pretty good understanding of the market. Jay Clayton from the SEC seemed to be just totally fed up with what he's been seeing in the ICO world, which I'm sure is full of scams. So I'm curious, how are they going to bring enforcement, especially to these ICOs, and how are they going to differentiate between the ones that like seem obviously scammish versus the ones that are trying to shoehorn their way around being a security? Is that something that worries y'all in terms of investing in tokens?
Well, I mean, I think that the ICO market seems to have other problems, you know, and I think that some regulation of it is probably good. And I guess I just have a hard time figuring out how they're going to distinguish between, like, you know, just to put it very bluntly, good and bad ICOs. You know, like everything right now is so impenetrable and it's so opaque that, you know, we have a hard time figuring out what is like a real ICO and what's a bad ICO. And then you have things like B-Token, which was a very, very hyped ICO, which a lot of people seem to be behind, which, you know, if you were going to pick one of the ICOs recently that people were like, oh, well, that seems like a real project, it might be B-Token, and then they get hacked, you know, and somebody steals like $1 million of Ethereum, is that right, from their ICO? And then they have to figure out how to do that. So I don't know how they're going to figure out what is a good ICO and what's a scam pump and dump ICO.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of questions there around how that'll be enforced. So far, in terms of market response, Bitcoin seems to be responding okay. Ethereum also seems mostly okay today. So it doesn't seem like there's thus far like a ton of clarity in regards to how the market will respond. But I was personally a little taken by how broadly the SEC commissioner seemed to be against ICOs, really not giving a ton of room for any form of public offering. Now, he seemed okay with the concept of creating tokens that are only available through private sales, or like the way traditional private equity is distributed. So we'll see. But that was my biggest gray area that I came away from with that whole meeting. And I'm sure part of that is because he just sees enormous numbers of abuses within the market. So like the bad actors could hurt everyone.
You guys are coming to this, I think, mostly from a perspective or... we're talking about this in a way that relates to the stock market and to securities. The other sort of parallel here is Silicon Valley startup investing. And a lot of these issues came up a few years ago, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, where basically people wanted to band together to invest in startups who were not accredited investors, where the accredited investor would allow people to sort of pool themselves. I know that like AngelList had a product where you could like, same thing, clone, jump on investments. And a lot of the same ideas are at play here. And a lot of the same hype was there that it was like, oh, in a year, you'll be able to put 25 cents into a startup if you want to. You'll just buy into this thing. And as I recall, the SEC is very, very suspicious of and against people who make under a certain amount of money a year or don't in some ways qualify as an investor being able to directly buy into things. And I think that skepticism is going to be there regardless of like what you call it, or you say, oh, this is an ICO and this is not an ICO. They're very committed to keeping consumer low-level investors out of these ploys, whether they're scams or not. I mean, it's weird to say like we're against scams and pump and dumps. It's like, obviously everyone's against scams and pump and dumps. No one's like saying, hey, I'm launching a new pump and dump scam. Like, Those are all going to be mixed in.
At a minimum, you could look at an ICO today, and if you're in the U.S. at least, if they're offering the ICO to Americans and they don't have Know Your Customer rules, where you qualify as a certified investor, which I think it's over $1 million in net worth and 250,000 a year in income to qualify. If they don't have those Know Your Customer rules in place to allow you to participate, they're at a huge liability. Like any competent lawyer would tell them they're insane for not requiring Know Your Customers type stuff. So that would certainly be a takeaway. And that's a really interesting comparison you made about like AngelList style products. And I remember that. At the same time, it seems like almost an inevitable future where something like that's going to have to occur, where you have equity-based products for small dollar investors. Because right now, like you could look at Kickstarter as almost the same thing. Like, right. Are they cracking down on Kickstarter?
Well, but the big difference is that Kickstarter does not offer any ownership or any ongoing stake in exchange for your money. It like you're putting the money in and you're getting like
but
a
but it feels
back.
Equally dumb of a loophole almost.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I like, well, it's ironic that Naval of AngelList is now like a major crypto guy. Like it actually seems literally like the people who tried to do this for startups are now trying to do similar things along the lines of crypto. I'm just a little skeptical that everyone's just going to keep getting fooled by it having a new name or like a new structure. Like an initial coin offering is just like offering someone ownership in something, right? Like, am I missing something?
Yeah. Well, the way they talk, yes. The way the SEC commissioner said today, no.
Right. Yeah.
Every single ICO is proposing the token as typically a utility token or an app token that has inherent value to an end user. And meeting that criteria, it would be fine as is. And that's what was interesting about what the SEC commissioner said today, was because he was essentially saying he didn't really see the fit in terms of truly being a utility token. And I personally would rather see the ICO market move to a realm where it was an equity token offering. So essentially it's like buying stock in a private company and just call the spade a spade. Because a lot of these, I think Ethereum or Bitcoin or some other major existing currency could be the token of exchange already. And the token itself is more like a share of stock. A lot of these projects might be worthwhile projects, but they really are, they seem to me to be squeezing the token into the product or the platform when it doesn't necessarily need to be there, other than the fact that that's what makes it legally have the proper standing.
Has anybody ever used a utility token? Like, do you know anyone or is there anyone on Earth?
SpankChain.
Like, nope. Is SpankChain even a utility token?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just like, you can keep calling them utility tokens, but if no one actually uses them for a utility, it very transparently becomes a workaround.
Well, I think two examples that come to mind, and I'll... Granted, I also own these.
One of them is SpankChain.
Yeah.
No, not SpankChain. I don't have SpankChain. But like ZRX, the ZRX token will have some inherent functionality in its own blockchain that's off the main Ethereum chain, where the ZRX token is used for the trading mechanism. And that way, like if you own EtherDelta and you trade, it's fully on-chain with Ethereum. So you're subject to all the slowness of the Ethereum network and whatever else is going on the Ethereum network. I almost imagine it like shared computer hosting, you know, like you deal with whatever else is out there. Whereas if you use a token like ZRX, the ZRX exchanges, the ones that support it, they're using ZRX as the token because all the activity is on the ZRX blockchain that's a off-chain solution from Ethereum. So that's a utility token at work. Now, whether you need that token or whether it can still be Ethereum or something providing the base layer token mechanism is, I think, perfectly up for debate. And I think we'll see a lot of changes in innovation, especially as the legal framework is clarified over time. So on the whole, as someone investing in these things, it worries me a little bit about stuff that I'm currently investing in to see how it may be affected. But I am excited to see, as long as they don't, kind of reduce the possibilities for innovation and change. I'm hoping that they'll clarify some of this stuff so that the technology can shift in a way that still brings these new technologies to the forefront, but also fits within the regulatory framework.
Yeah, I that's like what you described is the sort of the thing that I can never resolve in my head myself, which is that, like, if I don't know how to think about it, you know, like, I believe in the 0x project, let's say, or let's say I believe in waves, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I would rather just have a way of buying a share of those companies than having to buy these tokens and pretend that it's a share when it's not, you know? And
but in a true utility token, the token itself has a use case. Another one that I was thinking of was Power Ledger. So, like, on that one, it's an energy token where that token needs to be able to do these microtransactions between different energy consumers and providers, and it keeps a ledger of the energy of the grid, basically. So, like, something like that is perfectly deserving of its own token.
For sure, for sure.
But what, from a regulatory sense, how do you think the government will interpret this as a future utility but not a present day utility? Like, I could sell futures in Mars rocket ships and be like, I'm going to use it to develop them and this will buy you one ticket. But would that be acceptable if I have no ability to actually launch a rocket to Mars?
Well, what we're doing now is we're not investing in the rocket ship trip to Mars as a corporation.
Yeah.
When you buy a token, that's what we think we're investing in. That's what it feels like. And that's what the SEC is worried about, because that's not what you're buying. What you're really buying is you're saying, well, I believe in this rocket ship mission to Mars, and this very specific type of Mars mission fuel is required. So that's the underlying mechanism used for this trip. So I'm going to buy that fuel because there's value in that fuel, and that fuel itself is, you know, limited in its ability to be created or whatever. So, like, that's actually what you're buying when you're buying these tokens. You're not buying equity, but the way it's sold, sometimes the way it's marketed, which is where it gets dangerous, that is where right now you're basically buying, you feel like you're buying equity, and these regulatory bodies are trying to ensure that the organizations are not pitching them like, hey, this is you buying equity.
I think that's a good, I mean, I don't know. Do you think that's a good outcome? I feel like that's probably a decent outcome. Honestly.
Yeah, I'd say this is about as good a shake as they were going to get. I can't really see them. I can't really see this hearing having gone like significantly better than it did. Can you?
No, I think for the four ICOs and stuff, they got about as much as they could hope for. I think that they need to figure out a way to start calling a spade and still support the ICO framework, because there's obviously demand for it from investors, and how that affects the US in particular, because other countries, investors can invest in securities tokens. It's not a big deal. That's why it's basically the US that's banned from these. What I hope doesn't happen is the US investors essentially get left out in their ability to invest in a new wave of technology.
It one thing that's come up on our show a lot that just sort of like a pet peeve of mine is the shift from mined coins to pre-mined coins. And I feel like a lot of this stuff is coming out of the era of, we just like made a gazillion dollars out of thin air. We just made these coins and now immediately we're ICOing them. And it's for something that's going to occur in the future. And when Bitcoin and mined coins did that, they were set up in a way that people had to have longer term skin in the game, because the coins are going to be pushed out over a period of time. It's, if it's a get rich quick scheme, it's not that quick. And it seems to me like you really invite the wrath of regulators when it's not only like made out of thin air, but it's all made in an instant out of thin air. And a lot of these utilities have that feeling. It's, we're going to sell it now and then figure it out later. And I think that mining is part, you know, part of the elegant design that's been lost in some of these utility token kind of altcoin kind of projects. And I could say the same thing about Ripple or anything, is how those stakes unfold over time and who really sees the benefit of them. And I do think ICOs are generally set up to benefit the people issuing the token in the extremely short term.
Yeah, man, I think you nailed it. I think you have a pretty nice take on this market. And like all of our listeners that are Bitcoin and proof of work maximalists are going to be pretty excited.
Excellent.
because the importance of governance shouldn't be lost on investors. The importance of token distribution. And I think the stuff that we'll see fade away are the things that are in blatant disregard of that. Like, Tron is a great example.
Be careful.
Yeah, Jay was like, hey, Tron's definitely dead. And then he
declared the phone. I've declared Tron dead two times now, and then checked before checking the price, and both times it's been like surging 30%. I'm not saying
the Tron.
So check
the Tron army can come after me. I'm ready to ball.
Ledger says Tron dead forever, 100% for sure.
Well, it may have room left in it. But I'm saying in terms of its token economics, its founder reward, the kind of everything about it, to me screams problematic.
Yeah.
That's not the type of thing I'm willing to invest in. That's why even though I do technical analysis, to me, there's a fundamental smell test that needs to be done on anything that you're putting money into, whether that's a proof of work coin that has a huge pre-mine that goes towards the founders, or whether it's an ICO or whatever else it is. I think we need to be able to pay attention more to fundamentals in this market and consider that whenever we're doing our investments. And I think that would be healthy for the market to essentially self-regulate in a way to where we don't give these projects that don't have good fundamentals, we don't give them any credence or credit.
I think that's probably, if there's one way I hope that I will invest differently on the next ride up, should it happen, would be, I think I'm just going to stick away from the stinky projects, even if I think maybe that there's money to be made on them. Just having like been holding a few of them on the way down, it sucks. Like it
hurts
sucks
more
to lose.
When the project
yeah,
sucks.
It sucks to like lose money on like on stinkiness, I think.
Yeah. Hey, what's next for Coin Talk Show, guys?
It's a good question. Coming up.
I think we're talking to the founder or one of the people who works on that Civil project, which is a little bit more in our world, which is a journalism based blockchain thing project. And I'm not sure what else.
Yeah, I mean, I think our general like philosophy is trying to cover this stuff from every angle. So have on people who are like really deep in like cryptography. And then the next week you've got someone who's launching an ICO. And the next week you have on a skeptic and really trying to sort of like show all of the weird confluence of personalities and objectives that are happening in crypto right now. So I did try to get Bitfinex to come on this week. Oh, and
don't have him on.
Well, he doesn't think my voice disguising software is robust enough, which I dispute because I think I could put together a pretty good voice disguiser. So if you're listening, Bitfinex, I can make it work.
He's probably not.
But yeah, we're just going to keep rolling with it. Look, we didn't know, like, I mean, I'm sure that you're dealing with this also. Like when you start a show in this realm, you don't know what it is you're going to be covering because you don't know where the market's going. And this is definitely not, I think, the party that we expected, but we're just going to keep going where it takes us.
Awesome. Well, I think y'all are doing a really awesome job. And I know you talk about kind of translating crypto stuff for the broader masses. I actually think your conversation have, while they've been effective in keeping them non-technical enough for people, you know, normal people to understand, I think you actually have brought really great guests, myself aside. I was the most boring episode in my opinion.
No.
But you had the lawyer that helped really reduce a lot of the Korea questioning.
Yeah, we ended Korean FUD once and for all in a single episode.
You did, and you ended all Korean FUD. You had a degenerate gambler besides Jay.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You've had everybody.
Right. Yeah. You think right you now. Got wrecked.
Oh, imagine if all you had was waves.
100% alts. 100%.
Yeah.
And
I think y'all have had awesome guests, great content. It's probably my favorite podcast in the crypto ecosystem
right
now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, we got to have you back on, and maybe we'll get Carpe Noctem with you next time and run it back.
Awesome. Sounds good. Where do people go if they want to subscribe?
We're at medium.com/cointalk, which also has transcripts of every episode, should you like to enjoy them that way, or just type Coin Talk into the podcast app of your choice.
Awesome.
Thanks, man. I really am. I'm enjoying that Telegram channel quite a bit.
Yeah, Telegram channel is good stuff. I love how no one else can comment. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, I'm not going in here in 100 years. I don't want people commenting. I was like, oh, this is a one-way channel? Sign me up.
Yeah. Yeah, so right now on the Telegram channel, and I'll link it up in the show notes, it's just free distribution where I'm just kind of expounding on the market a little bit more. You can't respond. It feels like I said recently, I feel like I'm like, preaching in an empty cathedral, but has 1,000 ghosts.
Yeah.
But it's been fun. The Ledger Status Learn project, you can go to ledgerstatus.com/learn for that. That will have a two-way street communication. So there'll be like a Discord for it, but that's going to be a paid program.
You live in Alabama. Kind of you could probably rent out one of those, like a mega church after hours and actually give empty sermons if you want to take it to a video level.
Yeah, I think that's a little too sacrilegious for me personally. but I'll stick to the video content, but it does have that eerie feeling when you're just talking into a Telegram where you know there's some people on the other end of the line, but they can't say anything.
It's like being a substitute fun, teacher, though. But you can actually mute the class, which is awesome.
Yeah, I'm just giving the lesson. Y'all are nowhere to be found. All right, guys. Well, I hope next time we talk, Bitcoin's like $15,000.
Oh my God, that'd be so amazing.
That will be great. But we'll talk soon either way. Even at 3,000, we'll still be talking. So
sounds good. Happy trading, everybody.
All right, later.
Bye.
Monuments crumble in the blink of an eye. The easy river has just run dry. In a house of cards.